Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
Today on Open Loops, we have David Edward, author of many books, but in this case, we're going to be talking about something very specifically that is going to make a lot of sense for you longtime listeners. Atlantis Solved, the final definitive proof. That's right. This is the book we're going to be discussing because, David... He was a special agent in the U.S. Army. He was in charge of the 1990 Panama Canal counterterrorism threat assessment report. I mean, this isn't just, like your everyday open loops quackpot or crackpot. But no. This is a guy that is legitimate and it really has substantiated a lot of his claims. He even invited me to challenge him on a lot of things before this interview started. So I'm excited to delve into what he's uncovered about Atlantis. David, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Greg, thanks for having me. I think I can live up to any crackpot metric you want to put out there. I'm sure I can meet it as part of our conversation here. Yeah.
I hope you do. I hope you do. Yeah, I'm kind of wondering. I mean, does this get as weird as advanced? Okay. Well, you know what? We can build to this. We can build to this. But I will say that I am already thinking about sound-driven levitation building pyramids. I mean, are we going in that direction? Do we think it could be similar? I mean,
no,
I am
the least fun but most interesting Atlantis person that you're ever going to have on. I tell people when you invite me on, I'm basically like I'm like the Grinch who stole Christmas. Right. Christmas is going to happen. And we've got the presents and they're in the boxes and they're under the tree and they're beautiful. And we're dreaming about what's in them. But when we open them, tube socks and underwear, it's going to be stuff we need. It's not going to be a nuclear submarine or a spaceship or a death ray or any of that stuff. So my exploration of Atlantis, I have one foot in the academic community. I mean, you mentioned some stuff. I have a doctorate in engineering, a whole bunch of master's degrees. I've been president of a university. I've taught this stuff. I've taken the courses. So I have the academic side. But I'm also, I've seen every episode of Ancient Aliens maybe twice, if not more. I've read many of the books in this space and most of the videos. And I've watched as much as I can stomach of the YouTube stuff. I mean, thousands of hours. I'm not, So I love that stuff. And what I'm trying to do is bring them together. And when you bring them together, you've got to look to the sky, but keep your eye on the ground because you don't want to trip, right? So that's kind
totally.
Of, that's kind of my approach to Atlantis.
Very interesting. I mean, did you, well, look, this does seem like kind of an arcane topic based on your career. I mean, people with an engineering background, people that work in the Army. I mean, look, I definitely have people that claim they were part of the Army and have seen flying saucers and stuff like that, but this feels a little different. I mean, you seem to be very grounded in things. Was Atlantis even on your your roadmap of things to explore or anything that delves into this kind of interesting esoteric space? Was this ever a part of your trajectory, I suppose?
Yeah, it's always been. You know, so when I was a kid, I was a nerd, fat little kid. I liked ice cream and watching TV, and I read all the nerd books and all that stuff. I barely made it out of high school and flunked out of college. The college and I figured out that we weren't for each other in about 3 weeks. I mean, we both kind of reached that conclusion right away. So it was awesome. But I knew I had potential. I knew I needed discipline. So the scariest thing I could think to do is an overweight, you know, kid, was join the Army. So I joined the Army.
Wow.
When you go into basic training, if you're overweight, you go to what they call fat camp. So I got to do a week of fat camp, which was wonderful. All you do is walk or run. That's all you do. But they got the weight down. And then you take this test. It's called an ASVAB test. And I took it and I scored high in whatever they were looking for, because they were having a hard time filling these counterintelligence positions, 97 Bravos. I joined as an 11 yeah. Bravo. So I got the bonus. I got like a $5,000 bonus, which was great. But yeah, then they recruited me over to military intelligence. Well, I mean, it's not like a movie. I mean, it was very administrative, and my test meant that's where I was going. It wasn't a conversation. It's not like, okay, son, you know, if you accept this mission, it's like none of that. It's like, okay, now I'm getting this bus, go over here. Now you're over here. It's like, okay, fine. But anyway, I did all that. I wound up in Panama. So I was part of the team that arrested Noriega. I was attached to the DEA for a long time on the war on drugs after Noriega, because all that was going on. I took a 10-day course on jungle survival. And the last thing you do is they cut the head off a boa constrictor and you have to drink the blood. That's how you graduate. Right after that.
Wait, what? Is that real? Are you being sarcastic?
100% real. Yeah, absolutely. 100% real. Well, it was real when I went through. I mean, the jungle training center, jungle operations and training center in Panama, in Colon, on the eastern side. Yeah. But anyway, after all that, me and a buddy took a trip, and we went to this little town called Yaviz, which is right on the border of the Darien Gap. And that there's a whole area between the Panamanian-Colombian border. And I did it for fun. It was like sightseeing. I mean, it was rugged stuff. But you get through that, about halfway through, you come to this river. And, you know, you're on a tour. You know, you're hitting spots. These guys take everyone to the same spots. But in the middle of this stream, it's not really a river, it's like a stream, is this giant round rock. And on the giant round rock are all these petroglyphics, hieroglyphics, whatever, you know, carvings and stuff. And that was where I went. That was where it went from cool stuff I saw on TV and read about to something that I was staring at. And I knew where this rock was. And if nothing changes, very few people will ever have the fortitude to go see this thing. And it's not huge. It's not like I'm looking at the Eiffel Tower, but it got my head in that space. And then I spent my vacations when I was in Central America going to all the Aztec ruins and the Mayan ruins and, you know, all that stuff. So I got to see all that firsthand. Came back, I had a chance to reenlist, and I decided that college looked pretty good compared to my time in the military. Yeah, when my stateside assignment, when I came back, I was assigned to the 513th MI out of Fort Monmouth, who 2 weeks before I got back had been forward deployed over to Desert Shield, which became Desert Storm. So I spent like 3.5 years out of the country and in combat situations when I wasn't, you know, drinking the blood of boa constrictors in the Darien Gap, you know? So, right. That's a far path away from a fat nerd watching Eric Von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods on TV while eating ice cream. But that was my journey, and I owe it all to the Army. Best experience I ever had. I would never do it again.
Wait, was this stuff going on in the back of your mind that you might see? You know, I mean, I think that's what I would do if I was enrolled in the Army. And again, this is what I think about. You know, I mean, I know Jimmy Kimmel always asks the U.S. presidents this question about, you know, Area 51. But I would, if I was getting access to the Army, I would think I might have access to top secret things, and top secret things being evidence that there might be extraterrestrials or other kind of I don't know, metaphysical things that they're not letting out to the general public. Did you have that in the back of your head at all? Did you try to find any classified secrets? What was your experience?
Yeah, and all of that is romantic, and I would agree with you that would be a fun way to have it go. It turns out, though, one of the things the Army tells you, at least they told me, is, you know, look, we're not joining you. You're joining us. That's one of their early sayings.
Right.
Which is, you know, we have a way we do things and here's how it is kind of stuff. You know, and you kind of learn that. You have to figure that out. What I'm sure there are people that have that experience. You know, I dug a lot of holes. I learned the difference between, a trench and a footer. That kind of stuff.
Right.
And I got to do the counterintelligence stuff, which sounds cool, but it's not. It's so compartmentalized, and I had access. I had a top secret, I think it's K, TSI K. So I had some designations, and I read all kinds of top secret stuff, and none of it was interesting at all. Or you know, if I had just read it, I wouldn't have thought it was anything. You know, much less classified.
Yeah.
But that's my level. I was very, 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 very much the bottom of that tree. I mean, I ran the cases, but they view that as that's the grunt work, right? Getting out there in the field, which I loved it. I thought it was fantastic work. But yeah, no, I didn't have access to anything. I didn't even know when we invaded Panama. They didn't tell us till like 11 p.m. that night. So I didn't even know that was happening, you know, just to show you how they compartmentalize stuff.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. But you still, this intrigue of yours still persisted no matter what. I mean, how'd you get to Atlantis then?
Well, I've always read this stuff, and I mentioned I got out and I went back to school, which I did. I've got like 5 degrees now. I didn't want to have to discuss why I hadn't finished my education ever again. And the only way you finish, you have to get what they call a terminal degree. And the joke is it's terminal because it kills you, but you know,
so right.
PhD or whatever. Yeah, whatever. So when I did that, I took a bunch of classes and I read, in fact, they had a class. I went to Temple University for the undergraduate degree, and it was called Intellectual Heritage. And you make you read stuff and you got to talk about it. And when we hit the histories by Herodotus, I was like enthralled. So after that class on my own, I read all of Plato, all of Herodotus. I've read this guy named Xenophon, who I love. So I was very well read, in that stuff. And then, but it didn't go anywhere. And then I just casually, I like TV shows like The X-Files or Ancient Aliens, So, I mean, I was in that space. And then about a little less than a year ago, and I haven't mentioned this yet, but I'm an old guy. You know, I can see by the color of our beards, because we can see each other, that I might be a little bit ahead of you when it comes to beard color.
fair enough.
You'll discover this, but it turns out the older you get, the less sleep you get. So there was a period I went through, I just couldn't sleep. So I would, what do you do? So I come out, put my headphones on and flip through YouTube, because it's, it's the only thing, where there's content. And of course, I had watched all the Open Loop podcasts that I possibly could. I mean, I'd gone through all of that content.
Well, thank you.
Of course.
You would have had there was a time machine. I mean, come on.
Oh, I don't know.
But I appreciate
it. I'm being gracious. Yes.
You did have access to the U.S. military time. Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Though.
So it's served up this video by this guy named Jimmy Corsetti on this channel called Bright Insight. And I came to the game very, very late. These videos broke open. Most people know about them if they like the Atlantis space. Some people agree with them, some people don't, but they certainly know about them. And in 2018, he had found this thing called the Rishat structure. And he put a couple videos together that said, this thing looks a lot like Atlantis. And it was convincing. And I watched and I was like, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. I've never, I've watched all the shows and I've never seen anything this compelling. Now, I've since talked to him, because I didn't want to. I told him, I said, look, I'm going to jump into this space. I don't want you to think I'm stealing your stuff or anything. But, my view of him is incredibly bright. He can deliver a message a million times better than I can. He can present data, but he didn't have the academic background that I could kind of put together. So he didn't really know how to collect and present and do it in a way that's going to hold up to those type of arguments. Because of that, incredibly interestingly, and I have all kinds of secret stuff that I'm going to tell you, Greg, we're going to blow the doors off a lot of things.
Oh, yes.
There's a Reddit sub called Alternate History.
Okay.
And I'd found it. It's got like 100,000 subscribers and I was interacting with it, but they really don't like this Jimmy guy. And they don't like this Rishat theory. And I could never figure out why. So finally I did a poll and I started posting and, talking to them individually. It's about half of the people in that sub, there are like history teachers and academics and stuff. And what they do is they monitor that sub for people coming in with ideas. And when they see something that they want to squash, they get this, it's like they're, you know, so they're like testing the waters, and then they'll come out, and then they'll, a whole bunch of noise will be generated across schools to kill an idea that was starting to take shape and showed up in that form. It was just, it was insanely crazy. Yeah, I just figured all that out within the past couple of weeks.
How did you find that out? Did you talk to anybody on the inside? Did you have to play undercover?
Look, I am trained by the United States government and army as an investigator, you know, so I know how to run misinformation campaigns. I know how to put out questionnaires and do things and ask questions and put a picture together when people don't know I'm collecting the data. And that's exactly what I did on Reddit.
Yeah.
So it's
a psyop. I mean,
It is. Now, there are many people on there who don't know that and are legitimately having these conversations, but it's all monitored by the academic community so that they can have counter arguments to any, you know, because basically the mainstream narrative is this dam that's so full of holes that they don't have enough appendages to stick in them. But it's still protected for a lot of legitimate reasons. Mostly self-preservation, but there's more to it. They believe that. So, you know, we will accuse the academics of not seeing things. That's not how they see the world. They believe their view, and they think that we're frustrating idiots who are running around, you know, with pink hair, yelling and making noise when they want to sleep.
That's interesting, but I wonder where your line is. I mean, look, we have to get back to Atlantis, but for instance, let's talk about the Nephilim, the giants that they claim were in the Bible walking around the earth. I mean, there's so many stories
I'm not in any of that.
I would say, where does the line of academia, did you ever have any lines of where you think they, how much are they covering up, do you think?
I don't think they're covering up. I think they're incompetent. And I don't mean the individuals. I don't mean the individuals are incompetent. I don't think any individual with a PhD who's out there teaching history or researching something, but the system they're in is fundamentally broken. And it's broken because it compartmentalizes data and it goes in and it brings in several biased assumptions. Here's what happened. Here's how our history formed, the history that you and I have. It formed through a religious lens. Now, we don't need to debate religion. It's got nothing to do with the religious aspect of that, but there was a very long period of time where all that information was controlled by the Catholic Church, and they had a view that the earth was 6,000 years old. So all history for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years had to fit into that 6,000 year timeline, and it did. And so they've dated everything within that timeline. A lot of it makes no sense, but they have a consistent story. Now, that's not the people we're dealing with. That's not the people of today. That's the system that they came into. Then they had to earn their way into that system from their standpoint, from an anthropologist standpoint or an archaeologist or a historian who's, you know, making what they consider not very good money at a community college or, you know, some undergraduate program teaching. They're killing themselves for this industry and to get the word out and do all of those things. But they also are very protective, which is if everything they've been saying for their entire career is wrong, then there's someone else is going to come in and say what's right, and then they're out. So a lot of not allowing the narrative to change is protecting their career and protecting their place in the social construct that has been built around education. The other problem with education is in order to have a finding, usually it's got to be funded by a research project by a university.
Right.
Well, go look like Yale University. That's not the name of the school. The name of the legal entity name is Yale University, Inc. So these are all just corporations. And they're nonprofit corporations. Which, whatever altruistic, you know, philanthropic, whatever the word is, things they do, the other side of that is they don't pay income tax and they can hoard as much money as they want, which they do. They're sitting on billions of dollars of cash reserves. So all of that's an empire. So you can't go after it because they're infinitely funded. They're all connected, but all the information is compartmentalized. Let me ask you this. All this public research that funds universities, why is the results of all that funding published behind paywalls? All these journals, you got to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars to get to. And that's everyone.
That's a great point.
No, yeah. But it tells you the reality of the market versus what we want it to be, right? What you and I want is there to be these brilliant academics wearing their white robes, walking around in the halls, figuring everything out so they can tell us what we need to know so that we can watch YouTube and, you know, root for Tom Brady, who I'm still rooting for him. I know he's not doing good. You know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But that's not the world. They're just like us. And they're stuck in their own little miserable system. And they have to defend it. God forbid they should step out of line. even if they have tenure. You've seen what happened. We've all seen it, not because of Atlantis, but because of, you know, things that society decides they don't want to support anymore.
Right.
For example, I had the dean of philosophy of Yale University, a very tenured and impressive person, who was going to talk to me because I wanted to ask her a question of how, you know, I'm gonna, in my research, I'm gonna assume that Plato is telling us true history when he says he's telling us true history. And I know that that's a controversial position. So I want to talk to someone of authority to say, what are the pros and cons? What do you think? And all that. And it was, and the meeting was set. I was going to have an hour-long conversation with her. Then the school found out that I was an Atlantis guy, and the administration stepped in and cut off contact. And she hasn't, and they canceled the meeting. And I've sent her a number of emails because I thought we had good rapport, and she hasn't responded to any of them. And I know it's not her, you know, it's the system she's in. So,
Yeah,
you know, work
that
against work.
kills me. That kills me because that's like the whole. I mean, that's why very early on I said, you know, look, if we're gonna talk about these QAnon theories, let's not just dismiss them. Let's actively debunk them. Let's actively debunk Atlantis. This, I mean, I just don't. I think that they don't understand. It seems that they don't understand the counterintuitive nature that if you don't talk about it, then it just perpetuates the crazies even more.
I think they understand. It's a combination of apathy and self-preservation. So mostly in these spaces, especially when it comes to the humanities, because there's such broad fields, all these folks that have these great educations, they specialize. So they become an expert in something very small. Basically, the way I describe it is there's a forest full of things to worry about, and each academic tends to take on a tree or two that's going to be their domain, and they become the expert. They can tell you everything about that tree. They can tell you how many acorns are on it, or, you know,
Right.
how tall it is, all that. But then when you try and talk about the forest, it's like, you know, you say, well, wait a second, maybe stuff was going on earlier than we thought. It's like nails on a chalkboard. They can't even conceive of the idea. Because if you change the construct, the context of what they're in, then their analysis of the tree could change. And they're an expert in this goddamn tree. So let's not
Yeah.
mess with that, right? They don't know what I'm talking about, but they know to defend their sovereignty over their little area. And that's what we're up against. And and with the internet and with all the ability to share information, it didn't solve it made it worse. The journals, it used to be you publish this stuff in a journal and it was a big thick book and it was printed, and there's a real legitimate expense to shipping that around to anyone who would just ask for it. You really can't do it for nothing because there's all kinds of costs. But sticking a PDF on a server to make it available, there's no cost to that. I've had IT guys come up and tell me I don't understand. I'm an IT guy. Trust me, if you've got a server sitting there, you can put a PDF on it and it's not going to mean anything to anybody. You know, it's not a money problem. But they didn't do that. They didn't change the peer review process and the publication process. They didn't adapt it for the 21st century. Instead, they took this old stupid way of doing it, and then they put all those controls over the digital assets. So they're all locked down and behind paywalls, and we can't get to them. And they don't pool their resources. It's like if you got 10 people researching stuff and finding things out that would affect the story of Atlantis, there's nowhere when they publish those 10 things in. This, by the way, there's 50,000 academic journals. So in some journal, it goes, no one is then pulling it together and saying, oh, look, this changes this part of the story. This changes this part. You know, I mean, I'm doing that now, but
Yeah.
there's no role in academia that does that. So that's why you get like the Graham Hancocks and the Randall Carlsons or the outside guys, they start doing that. And then the industry gets mad at them because as soon as you start looking at it holistically, you realize it's a piece of Swiss cheese as opposed to this rock solid, beautiful building that they tell you it is, you know, with a strong foundation. There is no foundation.
Yeah.
Graham Hancock says the foundation is built on sand. I think it's built on vomit. I mean, I think it's just, you know, the least unstable thing you could think of, I think is what it's built on. Yeah,
Have you ever
so.
met Graham Hancock?
I know, I have never met Graham Hancock.
Do you
I've
want
reached
him?
out to them all, but you know, I'm not a big enough fish yet. And you got to be a
Yeah.
little careful because I'm a little fish. So if I jump in the ocean with them, they might eat me.
That's true. That's true. But no, I mean, okay, let me ask you this. Do you believe that there, I mean, have you looked into it at all? Is there, have any, has there been any mainstream academia that has actually examined Atlantis in the way that you believe you have?
No. So, yes and no. There's been many that have gone after it. But like, for example, I think it was 10 years ago or so, there was a group that got funding to examine a spot in Spain. But see, that's how their world works, which is Atlantis is toxic unless they can convince someone to get funding to go do something. But so even in that case, they have funding to go look at this one spot in Spain, not to put the whole Atlantis story together. So we're up against it. No one is stewarding these anomalies like we think they are.
Yeah.
However, what I'm doing, and I'm promoting, I put all this on a YouTube channel. We talked about that. It's called A History Of.
Yes, and we will link to that for everybody. For sure. Man,
I appreciate that. But what I'm doing is I'm the premise of the channel is that, you know what? If we push all the noise aside, we go back to the Atlantis source and actually look at what it would mean to have found it. And then we look at what academia knows about the things we need to find it, not what they think about it, but what they know about it. It turns out we're not that far apart. And I started doing this, for example, I'll give you an example because we got to start talking about Atlantis. I know we probably lost everybody at this point, but there's a monolith. So one of the things with Atlantis is Plato tells us it was destroyed in 9600 BCE, which is a magical date. And it's a date that if he made it all up and he mistakenly or magically picked that date because he couldn't have known, he stumbled into it. And that the first problem is that date's magical, because that is, in fact, the date where we have all kinds of well-known, well-documented and accepted changes happening on the planet with temperature, with water levels and all that stuff. And we have, I can get into, like, we have this thing called the Younger Dryas, which everyone talks about. And I had to, when I came into this, you always hear this Younger Dryas. It's like, oh, okay, cool. What is it? What's a Dryas? What are you talking about? Well, turns out there are three things. There's a Younger Dryas, the Older Dryas, and the Oldest Dryas. And so, okay, well, then I had to find out, well, so what's a Dryas? Well, it turns out a Dryas is a flowering plant that does really well at higher elevations in colder weather. So what they do is when they go dig through the strata, they kind of know about where they are in time, and they look for these plants. And if they see a lot of them at the higher elevations, they know it was colder. If they see less, then they know that it's getting warmer. And what we have in 9600 BCE is this rapid shift. We don't know how fast it was. From a geological scale, it was instantaneous, but it might have taken a year, might have taken 6 months, might have taken 2 days. We really don't know. But very quickly, the temperature on the planet rose 30, 35 degrees Fahrenheit. So all the ice melted. The water, the sea level was 400 feet lower during the last ice age than it is today. So when I'm looking for Atlantis, one of the things I do is I lower the seawater because I want to see what the land would have looked like, at 9600, the time of the tale, than how it looks today. And when you do that, this magical thing happens around Sicily. What happens with Sicily is these two peninsulas form that include, like, the island of Mali. I'm sorry, I always say Mali. Malta. Mali is a country in Africa. Malta. And there's extrapolations you can do into the Atlantean story that I've done that no one else has done. Because I'm like a physical historian. That's like my thing. I want to see physical stuff. It's like we were talking. It's like Poseidon married a mountain girl and had seven kids. Like, I don't care about that. But when he tells me that his house was in an island that was five stadia and it was surrounded by, I care about the physical things.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but that's my approach. But anyway, long way around this little pond, on these sunken peninsulas that were only above water during the last ice age and before, they found Neolithic and megalithic constructions. One of the ones they found is called the Sicilian Channel Monolith. And I go through this in these videos, but when you look at those land masses that come up and you try and project back what we know about in the dialogues about what would have happened on them, there's some military stuff going on. Then when you look where these sunken underwater megalithic structures are and you put a military eye to them, that's something I bring. Most people who have these good educations, they don't have the military background too, right? Usually you have a good military person or you have a good PhD. Now, maybe you'll get a military person that has a master's degree in, combat something because they got to get promoted. But, these worlds don't normally come together. But anyway, when we start to look at where these megalithic constructions are with the military eye, they start making complete sense. And no one disputes that they're there. Matter of fact, there's an academic study that was done on the Sicilian Channel monolith that concluded the exact same things that I just said, which is this implies that there was massive activity, on this landmass before it was sunken, which pushes it back into the last ice age and all that stuff. Now, no academic then says, haha, proof of Atlantis, but they agree there's a bunch of rocks under there that someone put there. And as I always point out, you don't build megalithic constructions 400 feet underwater. You do it when the land's above water. Right. Yeah. So when was land above water? Well, it was above water in the last ice age. Well, when was the last ice age? 9600 BCE. What does Plato say Atlantis was? 9600 BCE. So you get those kind of associations. And that's the case I'm building. So I went for a very big case. And then the book we talked about kind of outlines the end of the story. So people that want to skip ahead and like to read the end of books or the, you know, the end of stories, you can read the book. What I'm doing in these videos is outlining the whole case of all the research I did to get to the conclusions that the book shows.
So wait a minute. Atlantis solved the final definitive proof. You are saying that, you agree with Corsetti, despite the disinformation campaign that's going on against him on Reddit and other channels.
I think he's right. He's not able, he can't prove it. Like, I believe he found it, but he's been everywhere. He's a brilliant guy. He's so much better at marketing. Matter of fact, he has a master's degree in marketing. He's an ex-army guy too. So he was over there, you know, during the Iraq war and stuff. So I agree with him. And in the big picture, I'm trying to bolster his voice by filling in all the holes and providing the actual foundation for him to stand on. Because what I'm not doing is I'm not defending him or his argument. I'm providing my own interpretation of why he's right, which is important. Because some people I talk to, they'll say, well, he said that, Molly has the highest birth rate of twins, and that's proof of Atlantis. So how can you defend that? Like, I don't know everything the guy said. I don't know anything about that. I'm a physical historian. I mean, birth rates in 9600 BCE are not my thing. But if you want to ask me where they're being born, I can go find a birthing center with little cribs. Yeah, I'll go look for that. It's an interesting world, and everyone's already made up their mind. It's the most interesting thing. When you tell them you're looking for Atlantis, the first thing they'll do is tell you that you're wrong, even before you say what you think it is, and then they'll explain to you their view.
Very interesting stuff, and I'm curious about how this contradicts a lot of the other theories that are going out there. I mean, I certainly know that. For instance, Graham Hancock, right? I mean, we have this Ancient Apocalypse series on Netflix that people are saying to remove because it's fiction. I mean, does your work challenge any of his views?
Look, it's tough. First off, I don't think it should be removed. I think that's ridiculous. It's not. Have you watched any of them?
I have watched it. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, I've only seen the first one. I didn't want to watch them because I don't want to start taking. I don't want to hear him say something and then have me take it on because I heard it from him. I want all my stuff to be, you know. But because of the controversy, I'm like, well, I can't be an idiot. I mean, if I'm in this field, I got to know what everyone's talking about. So I watched the first one. And it was the same stuff he always says. I've read all his books, by the way.
But
what he's doing, he and I would not agree, and he doesn't agree with Jimmy. He would not, if he knew who I was or if he'd ever listened to me, he wouldn't agree with me. Because what he's done, which I don't agree with, so I guess I don't agree with this. I hate to say I don't agree with an approach to him on something because it's going to sound like I'm piling on, which is not true at all. I think the guy is wonderful, and I just want him to do nothing more than have more documentaries and write more books. But what he's taken with Atlantis is he's treated it as a nomenclature or a brand, because the public is aware of the brand of Atlantis as being an ancient civilization that has been lost. And he has then taken that word, and he is using it for all of the ancient civilizations that he's pointing to, because I think he's pointing to a couple different ones. And he has kind of come up with this unified theory of oneness, saying maybe it was just one big global civilization.
Yes.
And I don't agree with that. What I'm doing, though, because what you asked me is a very important question, and I get it all the time. It's like in Atlantis land, people think if it's the Azores, then it can't be the Rishat structure. If it's Crete, then it can't be Santorini, right? If it's Doggerland, it can't be the Bimini Road, you know, whatever. So what I'm doing is building what I'm calling a unified theory of Atlantis, because for some reason, none of us read the actual dialogue. We just listen to what other people say about it. One of the things that's front and center of the dialogue is Atlantis was in 10 places. I don't know. And I tell people this and they're like, they never heard it. I was like, how can you never heard it? Like, it's like the main thing. But he tells us there was a capital city and there were 9 provinces. So he actually, there is no plural of Atlantis. So it's not like it's Atlanti or Atlantises. It's just Atlantis, which is like mouse or what, goose or geese or whatever. There is none of that. But he tells us that Atlantis was a capital city, it was a continent, and it was a kingdom. So it's like 3 things, like New York. New York is a city and New York is a state, right? So in this case, you know, Atlantis was all those things. So what happens is someone will say, well, I think it was A. And someone will say, well, no, it can't be A because it was B. well, what are they even talking about? That's what I ask them. What are you talking about? What, when you say Atlantis, what do you, and usually they mean the city, the capital city. So they're right. arguing which one is the capital city, but there's almost no way to figure that out until we got lucky with this Rishat thing. But that's in front of us. We haven't got to that yet. But if there's 10 locations for Atlantis, maybe all these places are Atlantis, or maybe most of them are Atlantis. They were just provinces. And we have the names of the provinces. Well, we have the names of the rulers of the provinces, which is often phonetically related or identical to the name of the place. Like Atlas. Atlas was the king of the city, the capital city. But then we have the Atlas Mountains, which are in Morocco to the north. We have the Atlantic Ocean. So that name, Atlas, right? It travels. And we see that with the... So one of the things I'm doing is I'm phonetically, linguistically taking all of the names that we're given. And then you go back and you see, can I trace them to any of the locations that people think was Atlantis? And it turns out you can.
Right.
And it all comes together. That's
very
people to watch
interesting.
Videos. Yeah. It all comes together.
Did you, yeah, I mean, what about people? Let's go back to the Plato thing for a second, that this idea that the whole thing just could have been an allegory. I mean, sounds like it could be. I mean, it was a long time ago. We don't know everything.
We do.
Plato we do. Was, I we mean, know. We know.
Yeah, we know. You know? Well, here's the deal. Here's what we know. First off, you have a choice to make, and all of life is like this now. If you watch CNN or you watch Fox News, you have made a choice, and you go into watching one of those with assumptions. You either know you're going to agree with them, or you know you're going to disagree with them, right? Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have the same thing with Atlantis, and people are told it was an oral tradition, or Plato made it up, or Plato likes to use allegories. When you actually read the dialogues, and I've done a tremendous amount of research, it's in the videos on that channel on this, the story of Atlantis was chiseled in stone in the temple of Neith at Sais in 3000 BCE, which predates the Egyptian dynasty. So it's what they call pre-dynastic. The first Egyptian dynasty was 2900 BCE. The thing that historians decided to start calling them dynasties, not because all of a sudden they just showed up in Egypt, but because that's kind of when they started writing stuff down. So if the first dynasty is 2900 BCE, this Temple of Neith in the story of Atlantis was written in 3000 BCE. It was written down before the first dynasty. So it's one of the first things they wrote down. That's how important they thought it was. But this goddess, Neith, we never hear about her, but she's actually the mother of the entire Egyptian pantheon. All the gods we know, Ra, and you know, you pick your Egyptian god. She's their mom. We see the cult of Neith emerge in the Western Nile Delta in 6000 BCE. Well, that's getting kind of close. We're pushing back towards Atlantis times, right?
Yeah,
I'm not saying 9000 is not 6000, but 9,000 to 6,000, 6,000 to 3,000, 3,000 to 0,0 to us, those are all time periods we can understand, you know? Anyway, so you look at this, and that's where the story comes from. Well, that's where it was written down. Then you got this, then you got the Greeks that start inserting themselves. You got this guy Solon, Plato tells us, who goes to this temple and talks to the priests. And he's asking them questions because Solon, and these are all real, he's a real historical figure. He is arguably the father of democracy. He's the Greek in 600 BCE who said, you know, maybe there's another way to do this.
Yeah.
So then he was trying to figure this out, and he toured kind of the known world. When he got to Egypt, which of course was a big deal, Egypt was very powerful and very storied at the time. One of the places he stopped was at this temple, and he talked to the priests. They talked all kinds of things. Pretty soon they got to the Egyptian ancient history, and that's when they started to go over the Atlantis story, which he gave him. And then the priest helped him translate it from the walls where it was written into notes. So he took all the notes. And Plato tells us they helped him with the names, they helped him with the measurements. They made sure he had the whole story. So he wrote it down. So he transcribed the history. Then he goes back to Greece. And then he has a brother named Dioperdes, who has a son named Critias, who gets called Critias the Elder. And Critias has a son, I can't remember his name, who has a son who names him Critias, who becomes Critias the grandfather, because he's the grandfather of, he has a son who has a son who gets named Critias, who becomes Critias the Tyrant. So we have three Critiases, all real historical figures. And Critias the Tyrant's well known. He was one of the 30 tyrants in Athens in like 402, 401, when just, you know, he did some bad things. But anyway, The Platonic dialogues have two dialogues where Plato mentions Atlantis. One is called Critias and one is called Timaeus. And the big thing that I unravel that no one else has solved is which Critias is speaking in the two dialogues, because they seem to contradict each other. Hmm. One of the Critiases says that he received Solon's writings, he still possesses them, and he studied them. And the other seems to say that he heard the story when he was 10 years old from old man Critias when he was 90. It's like, okay, that's contradictory until you actually realize there are three Critiases. And when you look when they were born, Critias the tyrant was 10 when Critias the grandfather was 90. So we know, and that would have been 420 BCE. So we actually even know when that conversation happened. And then Plato writes all this down in 360 BCE. And that's transmitted to us today over just as long a time gap as any of those other time gaps, just to get that on the table. So the fact we know about it is the same amount of time as they would have known for any of those steps that I gave you. So Plato specifically tells us it's not an allegory and he's not making up. He says it's real. And in all of his other dialogues, he tells you if it's going to be an allegory or like there's one called The Laws, which is the most boring. It's like that thick a book. It's a huge book. It's the most boring thing you ever read. But in the middle of it, they start talking about time travel and the dead coming back to life as zombies and people being unborn and all kinds of stuff. And then at the end they go, okay, well, we got to quit making stuff up. Let's get back to, you know, our real conversation. Mm. So he always bookends. He's very careful actually to bookend when he's doing an allegory or when he's presenting something that I believe he believed was true. Then he puts the lion's share of the information I'm using, the physical information, the physical descriptions of Atlantis, he puts them in the Critias dialogue, which is the Critias there is Critias the grandfather, which is the more trusted Critias. So people accuse Plato of lots of slippery and doing lots of things, but we ought to give him credit too when we find those kinds of things. So when you dig into all of this, you've got to push away a lot of noise. You've got to push away what people think they know or have been told because everyone's been told something wrong. And it's actually... There's a very good chain of custody, better than we have for almost anything else from that long ago.
Holy moly! I mean, you really did just give a great support of Plato's history and certainly, I mean, if these things are out there and engraved, why are we saying that academia denies so much of, I mean, what is academia's answer? Are they just saying Plato's completely bonkers?
Academics would say, we think that Plato is fiction, so we don't accept any of those arguments. And while we absolutely know where the temple was, it's ruins now, though, you know, it's gone, it got blown up. So we, you know, they have to go restore it and they may or may not find the writings. So it all, in academic research, it's all about your assumptions. Right. I mentioned this earlier. So I have an assumption. I state it very loudly everywhere, which is in this research, our primary assumption is that in the dialogues Critias and Timaeus, the parts that Plato tells us are true history, our assumption is that they are true history. Mm. So that's my lens. When in academia, their lens is the opposite of that. Plato might have been a smart guy, but he wrote down all kinds of baloney. That's their going in assumption. So then you say, well, Plato says that he went to the temple of Neith and Sais, and that's what was written down. Ah, Plato's full of it. You know what I mean? And then there's no inquiry after that. Plus, remember, they go where they get paid or where they can get funding. So we would have to find an altruistic person who's willing to dump, you know, $50 million into an academic research program. And if he did that, man, we would have so many historians and academics that love Atlantis. This would be, I mean, that, you know, they've been afraid to say it, but their whole lives are dedicated to finding it. And they all know more than I do for sure. And they would go out and spend all kinds of time on it. But I don't know that we're going to get that.
Do you think there's an academic out there that does know and is deliberately covering it up?
You know, that's such a tough question. I would say that there are many that have been presented with data that they could have chosen to analyze or spend more time with and didn't, and therefore reached a conclusion in absence of that data. Which is, so in other words, I mean, so I'm being political a little bit, because I'm not trying to pick on anybody. I don't think there's an academic out there who thinks that's what they're doing. Let me put it that way. I don't think there's an academic out there who thinks they're hiding Atlantis from somebody.
It makes me think of psychic charlatans too, or charlatans. Not everybody is. I know. I know. Or at least, but in the sense that I think there's some people that are naturally intuitive that actually maybe aren't necessarily psychic, but think that they have this gift. So they're convincing themselves that they're doing the right thing. It's a kind of convincing yourself mentality. Like you're saying, it's an unconscious decision to just kind of.
Yeah. And then in all fairness, from their standpoint, not everyone's out to save the world and bring knowledge and all of that. So from their standpoint, they're doing the right thing because they're preserving their income for their family and their loved ones and their position in society and all of those things, which is all any of us really do. It's just the consequence of that, which they're oblivious to, is they're on the wrong side of history. But it's not that important a topic, you know, on some level. So,
yeah. Well, tell me this. I need to know. I mean, you said you're bridging the gap between history and real like academia background and YouTube conspiracy theory videos. So I suppose my question is this, you know, what is the truth about, well, let's start here because a lot of people already are just, I think start from the assumption that they were high level space astronauts, whizzing with new products and or just new creations, and you know Nikola Tesla built his stuff based off the Atlantis. Is there even any evidence out there of the kind of technological advancements that they had in the first place? Oh, and absolutely. What is it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, there's lots of evidence. Matter of fact, so here's the challenge is when we say advanced, what do we mean?
Right.
Because it's not nuclear submarines. It's not UFOs. I don't even think they were megalithic builders of like we see in Egypt and Peru and Mexico. I think they were before that. Matter of fact, my theory is that all the megalithic structures we see are a response to what happened. You know, where people going, all right, you know what? We better build some big stuff because when those cataclysms come, you know, we want something on the other side of it. What Plato tells us is that they were very good at agriculture and they were very good organizing themselves. And I'll give you the examples of both of those. The other thing he tells us that we learned is when it came to waging war against a society that was just half-assed organized a little bit, they lost.
Right.
So because now he tells us that they conquered Libya all the way to Egypt. They conquered the Mediterranean into Tyrrhenia, the Tyrrhenian Sea. And parts of Europe and the continent, they say. At this time period, if we're going with what we know about history, there wasn't a lot of organized resistance in any of those places. Then Plato tells us that they tried to conquer the Greeks, and the Greeks got organized and beat them all the way back to the capital. And then that was when the disaster happened and it was destroyed and everything. So what was your question?
It was about the technological advancement.
Technology. Okay. Yes. So agriculture. So what does he say about the agriculture? He says, first off, he says that this was agriculture on a scale we've never seen before. He says there were 60,000 10 by 10 stadia farms on this giant 2,000 by 3,000 stadia plane. So what's a stadia? We got to answer that question. The Alexandrian measure, which was the measurement used when Plato wrote this stuff down, is 606.9 feet or 607 feet. So you multiply 10 by 607, you get 6,000 feet. You divide that by 5,280, which is about a mile. So he's talking about just a little bit bigger than a mile by mile farms, but 60,000 of them. And then he says that they had done earthworks and they had built a canal all the way around the plane of that farm. And he even says it's just like you wouldn't believe how amazing it is. And I've actually, we're not on video here, but I found evidence of that in Africa that we'll be getting to. The other thing he says, which he liked, because this is what Plato liked, he says that the way they organized themselves, they had the capital of the nine provinces. Each province was ruled by a prince, but the prince was pretty much a king, except that they agreed there were a few decisions like capital punishment and a few things they would defer back to the group of kings, the 10 of them. And they got together every 10 years or something. But the big thing that they did is they said they had a pact. They would never attack each other. And if any one of them was ever attacked, all of them would respond. Well, that's NATO. They invented NATO. This is in the Platonic Dialogue. So we have what became, you know, the idea that became NATO written in 20, 400 BCE. I'm sorry, in 400 BC, 2400 years ago, in 400 BCE.
Very wild.
That's advanced, I mean,
that is,
man.
That is pretty advanced.
That's very advanced. It's very advanced. Because yeah. From a societal standpoint, to be able to organize yourselves to do that, you know how hard that is even today? But they're doing it for the first time, or at least they're doing it without a reference, you know.
Yeah.
And they did it. They seems like they did it because, you know, we're told they were an empire. You know, it seems like if we're going to believe the story, that was what they did. So, yeah.
So there's no Stargates that we know of.
Well, the way I put this, I mentioned I'm the Grinch, right? I'm dealing with underwears and socks. I'm dealing with infrastructure. All I know is what we can see and what Plato told us in the dialogues. And of course, and things we know, and then what we know about ourselves. Those are my three points. So nowhere in any of those points does a nuclear submarine or a death ray show up. It's not there. It's just not part of what I'm doing. So, yeah, I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I know. There's, if you look through the various, there's just so much speculation about this. I mean, I'm even seeing stuff about batteries and steam engines and, you're telling me you're looking at Plato as your main source here. What do you think? Is there anything mind blowing about this what is the most mind blowing piece about this to you? I guess let's go there.
And let me just say on that stuff. I'm not saying it didn't exist. I just don't know. It's just not part of. It's not on my radar. And I wouldn't know how to find it or prove it. To me, this it's very important because what this date does is it puts a mile marker down in the sand at that 9600 date for right now. We think, you know, about 3000 BCE tends to be about, we think, the horizon point of us as a society. This would double that time period. And I think if we start looking at it from a unification standpoint, meaning, so, okay, the historians, they have a framework today that when they look at something, they assume that these ancient civilizations existed in isolation. That's just, that goes into all their assumptions. They assume that. That's one of their assumptions they bring in. I think this would bust that assumption, and that it would force us to acknowledge that all these ancient societies came up in, you know, aware of each other, and there was trade, and there were different things. Now, people will say, well, if that's true, we should find the plant DNA or whatever plants residue they leave. We should see crops from Europe showing up in the Americas and this and that. And we can't find that. And of course, okay. Well, how long does a 12,000 year old piece of corn last?
That's a great point.
Well, no, but I know, but that's, you know, so the other thing on the academic side is there is no intuition. If they found it and they're going to date it, it's the closest date they can announce, and only once they've found something will they move their story to include that date. So things like I just said, they'll say, well, there's no evidence of intercrop whatever, and then I'll ask that question, but it doesn't matter. They don't find it, so they think they're done. We didn't find it, it's not there. You can speculate all you want, Dave, but it's like, well, let's just think about it. We'll answer the question, how long does corn last? You know, I mean, you get into those circles, and by the time you're in that circle, you've lost, because they're now driving the conversation, and basically it becomes what I call Bring Me a Rock. You get this online too. Bring Me a Rock, it's a game where I'll say, Greg, bring me a rock. And you'll go out and you'll bring a rock back, and I'll say, not that one. You know, bring me the one I'm looking for. Pretty soon you bring me a big rock, you know, you're sweaty. I'm like, no, you know, I just, because I'm not telling you what I want. I mean, right. A rock is not descriptive enough. And that's where, and they're very good at, the academics are brilliant at positioning the argument so you find yourself there fairly quickly, because they're asking you for references and peers and both, you know, and they, which then pushes aside, and you start sounding stupid. Well, I just believe, you know, and so it's not a real conversation, but it's a real defense to any new information entering the field.
Yeah. I mean, look, and everybody, first of all, we'll link to your YouTube channel, History Of, where you can look deeper into this, as well as the book, mm-hmm. Atlantis Solved, The Final Definitive Proof. Let me ask you this very briefly. The work of Zachariah Sitchin. and Sumeria and, you know, all those myths and legends. Does Atlantis cross over to that at all? Because sometimes people conflate those things.
I think so. I think what we see, so all of those are civilizations that seem, well, first of all, Zachariah Sitchin's got all kinds of baggage.
Yes.
And I like the way he thinks, and some of his stuff is very imaginative. I haven't explored any of his views. I haven't verified or confirmed or disaffirmed anything he said. So I don't know about it. My intuition. So I'm now telling you, you know, this is my allegory or my intuition.
Yes.
Is that when you look way back, you know, we can only shine the flashlight so far back into the room, and you hit this 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 BCE dates. And everything we see there at the very end of the light doesn't seem like the beginning. It seems like we're shining a light to something that was very, very, you know, I don't want to use that word advanced. It was very evolved. It had been around and very mature. It was very mature. Let's not advanced, but whatever they're doing, they've been doing it for a while. And that's the frustrating thing to us on the outside is when we look, it's like, the farther back I look, it looks like it's the end of a story, not the beginning of a story. And so I think, so I think they all play. You have things like Göbekli Tepe, which I love. It's in Turkey. And they found a bunch of tepes. And this is the first time we've found a series of sites where we can start to see the evolution of the skill, the stoneworking and all those skills. Usually, like in Egypt, almost everything you go look at it is fully formed. With the Tepe stuff, we can see older Tepes and they kind of culminate in this Göbekli Tepe thing, which is kind of rudimentary. It's not even really megalithic. They use big stones, but not like uber big stones. Nothing that you'd look at and go, how do they move that or whatever. So I think that's the level of technology that Atlantis had. I think that's the level of technology that the high societies had in 9600 BCE. I think you look at Sumeria, you can look to, you know, the Turkey region, you can look to where I am, you know, we're talking about parts of Europe, parts of Africa. I think
so. You say you're the Grinch, but is there, I mean,
I'm the Grinch. But... Christmas and, socks and underwear is Grinch presence.
is there any fringe component to this? I mean, or is there anything one might classify as magical about this? I mean, I'm sure people do get disappointed. They think Atlantis is this highly advanced, you know, space astronautical alien extraterrestrial thing. Is there anything that is unexplained by today's standards about your research?
However, not the way you're asking the question.
Okay.
So there's nothing that is suggesting magic or death rays or any of that stuff. I still think this is incredibly interesting because I think these societies were way more advanced than us, to use that word, when it comes to their understanding of the planet and rhythms and all that stuff we can get into, you know, this kind of that fringe world. What was the question again?
In understanding the stars and the astronomy and just if there's anything that's a little, you know, I imagine when you were on Coast to Coast AM, people called in and said, that's not what I've channeled Atlantean people. And that's not what they tell me we have. You know, I mean.
You didn't listen to that, did you?
I actually haven't listened to that, but I imagine that's what happened.
That is what happened.
Yeah. What are the critics saying?
Remind me Crete, because Crete answers your question about anything I'm proposing that doesn't align to kind of mainstream views or that's interesting. But just anecdotally, yeah. When I was on that show, some guy called. He said he had done a past life regression and he was the assistant scientist who was running the death ray when the whole thing freaking went bonkers. And he was screaming to the lead guy that it's going to go. And then he remembers it went. And then he was seeing like a nuclear explosion and all that stuff. And I'm like, awesome, bro. Good. I don't know shit about that. I don't know anything about it. But I assume you're right. But yeah, I get lots of that. I've had people, when I used to have my phone number on the publisher's website, they contact me, and usually the ones that go to that level of energy to contact me aren't happy about something because they've in their core, like their self, you know, their version of themselves, they've attached to what they consider to be a memory of something that relates to Atlantis. And what they don't want to do is, and they strongly self-identify with it for whatever reason. And they might be right. I have no idea, but they don't want to hear something that comes along that discredits that view. So I've dealt with that, but let me give you an example. Crete is an island. It's a Greek island. in the Mediterranean. It's one of the southernmost Greek islands. And it is a place, in fact, any documentary that you've seen on TV about Atlantis, they usually start in Crete. And they'll go, and Crete's an interesting, exotic place. Academically, we know in 7,000 BCE, there was an agrarian transformation. So a transformation like we would expect to see with what we know about Atlantis. But 7,000 BCE is not 9,600 BCE. There's a big date. So when you look, so how far back is 7,000 BCE compared to 9,600 BCE from where we are right now? And it's 73% of the way there. So, okay. So everything else lines up with Crete. It's not the capital. It's one, but as one of those provinces, we have all kinds of, and we even have linguistic ties, and there's all kinds of physical evidence, but we have a 27% gap. We'd have to find something that moves that agrarian transformation from 7,000 BCE to 9,600 or thereabouts BCE. We don't have that academically. So there's a gap, but that's the only gap. For example, on Malta, that number, that 7,000 number that's on Crete, it was 5,200 BCE was the date that they started to see agriculture and stuff. But then in 2018, so 4 years ago, they found DNA evidence in a tooth or something that pushed that date from 5,200 BCE to 5,900 BCE. So on Malta, they added 700 years, 4 years ago, to the timeline. And these dates only ever move back. They're not going to find something on Malta that says, yeah, you know what? Yeah, we found the tooth from 5,900, but we really backed that 5,200 because of something else we found. The dates don't work that way. They only ever go back. So it's just a question of time. As the science gets better and as they look at other stuff, they'll tangentially find markers that push these dates, and they're going to align. We're just not there yet.
Yeah. Do you think you could take Edgar Cayce in a fight?
I eat Edgar Cayce's for breakfast.
What's the deal? This is the Atlantis guy. Edgar Cayce.
No, he's not. He's not the Atlantis guy. Look, there's a number of people that have used the word Atlantis to enter into the public eye. And Casey's one of those guys. I don't believe in what they call it, visioning. What does he do?
He channeled.
Yeah. I'm not a channel.
So many people channel Atlantis. I mean, it doesn't really lend a lot of credence to what's out there. But tell me this. Okay, so if we were to do a tour right now, if you were to take us on a jet, you could take us all to where you believe Atlantis is?
Mm-hmm. I could.
Have you gone out there?
I have not. I work with this guy, David Stig Hansen. And he's a good, I mean, work with his, we both believe in Atlantis. We're both looking for it. But he lived in Taiwan for a long time and he travels the world, and he was just there. He was in West Africa the entire month of October. And it was his second visit. And we corresponded. I gave him a list of stuff, pictures I wanted and things I wanted to look at and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, as an old guy, I've traveled, I've been everywhere, man. But now, yeah, I'm very happy sitting here in Florida and having David Hansen be the guy that's out there on the ground. The thing with Atlantis, one of the challenges with the Rishat structure, the capital city of Atlantis, which is what we're talking about here, is that it's absolutely beaten to death. It is beaten down to the bedrock. Whatever happened, there's nothing left there. There's just the bedrock of it. Looks like people think it was a collapsed volcanic dome or something. And it's in the middle of the Sahara Desert. It's in the Western Sahara. So like he went October, it was still like 140 degrees when he went out there. It's like, I went a little early. So he might go back like in January when it will just be 90. But yeah, the difference between 90 and 140 is quite a bit. But there's not that much to see. I know in the videos, and it'll be one of the last things that I release to the world. Hopefully I can build a big audience when I release it. Yeah. But based on my analysis, I know where to dig for it. And it's not the Rishat structure. But there's three, there's four, there's five geographies so far that if Atlantis fits what Plato said, are places that haven't been dug, that if we did dig, we would find stuff. If we don't find stuff, then Atlantis isn't what Plato tells us it was, which is telling too.
Now, wait a second. I do have to ask you.
Sure.
Before we wrap up, I mean, your book came out 2022. Mm-hmm. But a year before, now then look, I appreciate, 96 pages, but a year before, what is up with this guy Christos? You read his book? May 3rd, 2021, Atlantis, the Find of a Lifetime, Christos A-D-J-O-N-I-S. I don't know.
I think I've seen it. It's like got a picture of a scuba diver on the front or something.
Yeah. This guy's claiming... Okay. I'm curious if, this guy's clocking. Oh, he's got 160 pages. Well, that doesn't really need that much more. I thought it was like a 500 page book. Okay. Well, I'm curious what your thoughts would be on, these other people. I mean, okay. What right now, before we go, biggest myths you want to dispel? What are the things that people are saying about Atlantis that you would just wish you want to correct the record so we can set people on the right path?
That's a hard one. So Atlantis is a lot of things. It's a hotel chain in the Bahamas, and they just built another one in the Middle East somewhere, right? So we're contending with that. Atlantis is the idea of the metaphysical, and people have attached all kinds of things to that. Then in the Graham Hancock space, Atlantis is the brand of the time before, as he calls it. None of those things have anything to do with it, with the Atlantis that I'm looking for. I'm back with the source material and with Plato. I'm trying to solve a very specific problem. So if there's something I wanted to dispel, it would be that word is used the same way when they say it versus when we look for it here. I think that would be it. And then the idea that it's some allegory. It just clearly isn't. It's not that hard to look into it and discover where the history came from, and it wasn't made up. So I would want to dispel that. The book, it's a proof. It is a proof. Like remember in high school in 10th grade in geometry.
I love proofs. I was just talking about this the other day. They were my favorite thing to do. Yeah.
So that's what, there's not in there. I'm not telling you a story in the book. I just basically go through the dialogues. I pull them up. I decompose them. I break them down into requirements. I analyze the requirements. I provide the data, and then I reach a conclusion. So it's a very dry book. In fact, the comments on it, it's very well received. People say it reads more like a dissertation than like one of Graham Hancock's books. And even if you look at the comments, people that give it low scores say that I did prove that.
There's some nitpicky guys. I'm looking on Amazon down here. I'm going, what? They're not even saying anything. This is just. But
read them all. Like there's one that says it's a scam. It's like, well, it's not a scam. What would a scam be? But then you read it, it's like, this guy's a dick. He's ripping people off. But the book proves it. But so what? And that's like the worst review. And there's a 3-star review of some lady. She says, I hate this guy. I hate the way he writes. He's a condescending ass. Sure, he proves Atlantis, but it was a real chore to get through. It's like, I'll take that all day long. Because that's, you know what I mean? There's no one writing on there saying that it's not logically sound proof. That's, you know, that's not the criticisms.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you're a condescending ass. You're a Grinch. but you're okay with it.
Well, you gotta be. That's just, look, in today's world, we all think if we stub our toe, we can sue the guy that made the sidewalk, right? And that we are just, there were castles and we can't even be inconvenienced or else it's like World War III. I'm old school. Criticize me, because there's probably some truth to it. I mean, maybe the book is written a little condescendingly. That's not actually what it is. What it is I structured the book so that if you don't agree with me, I'm going to frustrate the hell out of you, because I don't make conclusions until I've laid out so much evidence. You have to go back and disagree with all the evidence, and you can't because it's logically sound. So that's where the condescending comes in, I think.
I love a good condescending argument. I do. And you weren't condescending with me. I felt, at least. So I appreciate it, and I appreciate the research you've done. Is there anything else? I mean, what's next? Are you going to look for the Ark of the Covenant?
No,
Tartaria? Yeah.
So what I'm doing is, I'm calling this season one on that channel. After I get done with all the Atlantis stuff, I'll have the big book come out, the Graham Hancock type of book that people want. That'll be Atlantis. And then we'll do season two on the channel. And for season two, what I'm going to do is an analysis of catastrophes and cataclysms on the Earth and how they align to the precession of the equinox and the precession of the stars and all of that. Because there's a theory.
That'll be good.
Right. Yeah. Not a lot of people look at it, but there's tangential, there's theories that the wobble of the Earth tells us where we are in its rotation over 26,000 years. And then it changes because of the wobble. It changes what star system is rising in the morning. It has been proposed that in certain locations in the galaxy that we're going to hit, that we can measure using this cycle, bad things happen to the Earth. And if you look at it over time, you can start to figure out which of those zodiacs it is, which means you can start to figure out where that is in space, you know, and when it's going to happen to us again. That's all I know. I don't know if that's true or not. That I know that's a theory. I've looked at a few things. It looked really compelling. I think that'd be a really fun thing. And it also kind of sets me apart. It gets me out of Atlantis land, which, as we've talked about, is a lot of elbows and knees on the dance floor in Atlantis land.
Yes, yes. Well, I appreciate the work you've done. My Christmas isn't ruined. Just, you know, my sense of Atlantis.
Well, you haven't opened your presents yet, Greg. If you've opened them yet, then broken the rules.
Exactly, exactly. David Edward, this has been amazing. A History of, check out the YouTube channel, as well as Atlantis Solved, the final definitive proof. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been a fascinating discussion. I love these things. So you really know your stuff. And yeah, grateful for your time.
I had a great time. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. David Edward, thank you so much for coming on. You know, my grandfather, Herb, he was the one that told my mom about Atlantis, and then she told me about it growing up, and he told me about Edgar Cayce. He would have loved this episode. He would have loved the scholarship behind it. He would have loved the archaeological debate. This one's for you, Grandpa Herb. Hope you're listening up there in heaven. And as I look at my show distribution, I could use a few more listeners up there, so, I mean, the other plays I'm doing great, but if you can get the word out, anybody, I'd appreciate it. Thanks so much.